So let's turn in our Bibles then to 2 Kings 17, and I'm going to read from verse 24 down to the end of the chapter. Might be a bit distracting this evening, mightn't it, with all the kind of bombs going off outside. But then the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cuthah, Ava, Hamath, and from Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel. And they took possession of Samaria and dwelt in its cities. And it was so, at the beginning of their dwelling there, that they did not fear the Lord. Therefore the Lord sent lions among them, which killed some of them. So they spoke to the king of Assyria, saying, "The nations whom you have removed and placed in the cities of Samaria do not know the rituals of the God of the land. Therefore he has sent lions among them, and indeed they are killing them, because they do not know the rituals of the God of the land." Then the king of Assyria commanded, saying, "Send there one of the priests whom you brought from there. Let him go and dwell there, and let him teach them the rituals of the God of the land." Then one of the priests whom they had carried away from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel, and taught them how they should fear the Lord. However, every nation continued to make gods of its own, and put them in the shrines on the high places which the Samaritans had made. Every nation in the cities where they dwelt. The men of Babylon made Sukkoth-Benoth, the men of Cuth made Nergal, the men of Hamath made Ashima, and the Avites made Nibhaz and Tartak, and the Sepharvites burned their children in the fire to Adrammelech and Anammelech, the gods of Sepharvaim. So they feared the Lord, and from every class they appointed for themselves priests of the high places, who sacrificed for them in the shrines of the high places. They feared the Lord, yet served their own gods, according to the rituals of the nations, from among whom they were carried away. To this day they continue practicing the former rituals. They do not fear the Lord, nor do they follow their statutes or their ordinances, or the law and the commandment which the Lord had commanded the children of Jacob, whom he had named Israel, with whom the Lord had made a covenant and charged them, saying, "You shall not fear other gods, nor bow down to them, nor serve them, nor sacrifice to them." But the Lord who brought you up from the land of Egypt with great power and an outstretched arm, him you shall fear, him you shall worship, and to him you shall offer sacrifice. And the statutes, the ordinances, the law, and the commandments which he wrote for you, you shall be careful to observe forever. You shall not fear other gods. And the covenant that I have made with you, you shall not forget, nor shall you fear other gods. But the Lord your God you shall fear, and he will deliver you from the hand of all your enemies. However, they did not obey, but they followed their former rituals. So these nations feared the Lord, yet served their carved images. Also their children and their children's children have continued doing as their fathers did, even to this day. So I want to begin this evening by, first of all, reading a short item from this month's PWMI magazine, Prophetic Witness magazine, and then we're going to watch a short video. It only lasts about 6 minutes, this video, and my reason for reading this article and then showing this video as part of the Bible study this evening is because what these depict really is two different responses to the current invasion of Europe by Islam. This article and this video show two different responses to the Islamic invasion of Europe from two different people who both claim to be Christian, and their response is because of their Christian faith, they would say. And these two responses are completely different. They're both women, but that's got nothing whatsoever to do with the issue here. It's just the fact that these are two completely different responses to the current Islamic invasion. Okay, so the first is this article, and it's like an item of news, really, that you get in this magazine, amongst other things. And it says, "The world's first lesbian bishop of a mainstream Christian denomination has put forth a call for one of the country's seaport churches to remove its crosses so as to make it less offensive to Muslims. Bishop Eva Brun of the Lutheran Church of Sweden has proposed to remove the Christian symbols of the Seaman's Church in Freeport to make it more inviting for visiting sailors from other religions. Her plan calls for removing crosses and other Christian symbols while setting up a prayer room inside the church that marks the direction of Mecca. The idea is to have rooms within the church that cater for people of other religions, thereby accommodating Muslim visitors. It would also make the church less offensive to the tens of thousands of Muslim refugees entering Sweden from the Middle East and North Africa as refugees. She said, this is this bishop, making a room available for people of other faiths does not mean that we are not defenders of our own faith. Priests are called to proclaim Christ. We do that every day and in every meeting with people. But that does not mean that we are stingy toward people of other faiths. Sweden has surrendered without so much as firing a shot, said Pamela Geller, author of Stop the Islamization of America. Sweden has lost it. It is sacrificing its own heritage to accommodate immigrants who will not be as accommodating to native non-Muslim Swedes. The bishop is paving the way for the Islamization of Sweden. So that's one kind of response to the Islamic invasion of Europe by a person who reckons herself to be Christian anyway. And on this video is another kind of response. So I'm going to want lights off for this.
Church, when the brave German woman, whose real name is Heidi Mundt, heard about the event, she prayed.
So yeah, two different responses to what is, in reality, an invasion of Europe by Islam. And that statement, it's actually what Islamists intended to do and stated that many years ago. They would infiltrate and take over Europe, really. And obviously the current refugee crisis is aiding that massively, you know. And that doesn't mean one isn't sympathetic to people who are there. It's just, I pointed out the other week, allegedly the Lebanese foreign minister told David Cameron that 2 out of every 100 of those refugees are ISIS fighters. Mm-hmm. And they've entered Europe without passports, without anything at all, and will be relocated all over Europe. So there you go. So you've got this. And there are two different responses to it. So we'll perhaps be referring back to that later, or it'll be obvious in a bit why I brought those. But to come back to the passage, what these invading Assyrians did was they carried away many of the Israelites and relocated them in various other countries. So back in verse 6, it says, in the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria, carried Israel away to Assyria and placed them in Hala and by the Habor, the river Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes. So they took, certainly from the wealthier classes of the Israelites, probably a lot of the poor were left in the land, but certainly from the wealthier classes, they were taken away and they were relocated in various parts of what was quite a huge Assyrian empire at that point in time. And then verse 24, it tells us they brought in others, foreigners from various different parts of their empire, and they resettled them in the land of Samaria, or Israel, the area occupied previously by the northern tribes of Israel. And really, the purpose of this, really, was their way of kind of destroying national identity and any sense of national sovereignty that people might have, that the conquered people might have. You take them away and you put them in other countries where there are different religions, different gods, different cultures, different lifestyles. You relocate them there and you bring people in who themselves are from other countries and they have different gods, different religions, different cultures, different languages. And you bring them in and you place them in that country. And the aim is that in the course of time they'll all assimilate and basically they'll break down any sense of national identity or sovereignty or allegiance that may have once been there and that people thought was worth fighting for, you see. So you remove the things that they felt were worth fighting for. And of course that was summed up perfectly in John Lennon's song Imagine, where in this verse he says, imagine there's no countries, it isn't hard to do, nothing to kill or die for, and no religion too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. That perfectly sums up the whole idea, you see. The idea is that nationality, sense of nationalism, you know, that causes war. You know, one's religion, that causes war. So if you can kind of get rid of all of that and assimilate everybody together, then you remove the cause of war. And it was summed up as well. You know, when I was preparing this, I was reminded, I go back a long time, me see, you know, and in the kind of middle or late of the hippie kind of era, there was a group called Blue Mink, and they brought this song called Melting Pot. I don't know if anybody remembers it. Yeah. Well, this is a verse out of Melting Pot, and it says, Rabbis and the friars, Vishnus and the gurus, you got the Beatles or the sun god, it's true. Well, it really doesn't matter what religion you choose. No, no, no. What we need is a great big melting pot, big enough to take the world and all it's got, and keep it stirring for 100 years of more or more, and turn out coffee-coloured people by the score. You remember that one? Well, we see the idea is that if you can kind of make everybody, you know, get rid of the religion, get rid of any sense of nationality, even get rid of black and white, you know, in the end, you remove all reasons for fallouts and wars. And that really was one of the purposes behind the policy of the Assyrians in, you see, relocating people in the way that they did. And it was actually a policy that many conquering forces have used down the centuries. They've done exactly the same thing and for the same reasons. And it's actually, in my view, what is happening today in Europe, albeit in a different sort of a way and for different reasons, it is what is happening today. You know, any sociologist or observer who can see it can see that the whole kind of face of Europe is changing massively. You know, its beliefs, everything, its culture, everything is changing. Its landscape is changing. And this is what is happening here in Europe and in Britain today. And you know what? I can easily understand why many people think in reality it's not a bad idea. You know, what Lennon's saying there, what that pop group was saying, that the whole idea of assimilation in that kind of a sense, I can understand why a lot of people think that that is a good idea. I mean, certainly I've met lots of people who honestly believe that religion is the problem. Religion causes wars. I don't know how many people have said that to me. And actually, it's true. It really is true. Religion causes war, and so does race division. It obviously it causes war. So the idea, and especially coming to the idea of religion, the idea obviously is that if you could, you know, get rid of religion altogether, in a lot of people's minds, that would be the best thing. But if you can't do that, if you could at least, you know, get everyone to either see the different religions as just different ways of worshipping God, you know, so it's all the same God really, they're just different ways of worshipping him, and you know, all the different religions call God by different names, but essentially it's the same God. If you can get people to sort of think on those lines, or else if you can get them to at least sort of you know, kind of tolerate one another's religious belief and accept them, the religion, as just a different expression of the race or the background or the culture, then it would go some way towards bringing in peace. You know, that's obviously the thinking behind it. But of course, if all religions were something akin to people's culture, you know, like you know, Indian people, you know, Hindus, you know, that's part of the history, that's part of the culture, and really there's little more to it than that. You know, it's just a cultural thing. And, you know, other people are Christians, and other people are Jews, and other people are whatever. And it's nothing more, that one's religious belief is nothing more than something akin to their mode of dress, or their art, or the history, or the culture, and there's nothing more to it than that. Then really there'd be nothing wrong with saying to people, look, well, why can't you just all accept each other's religion just like you accept the way each other dress differently or look differently? There'd be nothing more to it than that, would there? if that's all it was. But if there really is only one true and living God, and there is, and if that one true and living God has revealed himself definitively in his word, this word, and if it's true, as the scriptures declare it to be, that there is only one way that a person could ever be saved and could be brought into a right relationship with that one true and living God, then that effectively means that every other religion is false, doesn't it? No matter how sincere the people may be who follow those religions, no matter how nice or otherwise the people may be, if this is true, there's only one God, he's revealed himself in these scriptures, and there's only one way of salvation through Jesus Christ in these scriptures. If it's true what the Lord Jesus himself said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, no man comes to the Father except through me. If that's actually true, then this truth must be proclaimed. For it not to be leaves everyone in darkness, obviously, doesn't it? Those who know the Lord, if this is true, those who do know the Lord must serve him and him alone. They can't serve him along with Allah or whoever else, whatever, the Buddha or whatever else there is, can they? If this is true, then that is completely out of the question, isn't it? That you could pull other gods alongside him. If this is true, then those who know the Lord, then those who are his people, must contend for the faith once for all delivered to the saints, mustn't they? They ought to. They can't do that, what the woman says, to be accommodating to other people, if this is true. So again, coming back to the scripture, Israel had found itself under the judgment of God because they had turned their back on God. They had turned their back on God's commandments and God's statutes, and they'd gone after other gods, numerous other gods, and served them. And they were walking according to the ways of the peoples of the nations surrounding them, pagans in other words. They were doing what they were doing and following their gods. And for some of them, that meant a wholesale abandoning entirely of the God of the Bible in order that they might be fully devoted to some other god, like Ahab did, you know, when he served Baal. You know, exclusively Baal and Asherah, the religion that so people like that had turned their backs entirely on the God of the Bible to follow after some other god. But for others, it was more of a kind of pluralistic syncretism, which is a big word for somebody who comes from Bolton. But by that I mean pluralistic syncretism is like the acceptance that there is more than one way, and kind of joining it all up together, mixing it all up together, so that it's a kind of acceptance that, well, you know, there's merit in all these different religions, and we can, you know, that perhaps they're all a different expression of worship to God and different ways of looking at God, but whatever way you look at it, you can kind of mix it all up and bring it all together, syncretize it all together, you see. But either way, whether one has totally abandoned the God of the Bible, or whether one has kind of thinks one has retained the God of the Bible and joined him with other gods and mixed it all up a little bit, it's still spiritual adultery. That's what God calls it. It is spiritual adultery. And because of that, God's judgment came upon these people of Israel, as we've been looking at in detail over the last few months. God's judgment came upon them, and God removed them from the land. God removed them from his sight, verse 23. The Lord removed Israel out of his sight, as he had said, by all his servants the prophets. So Israel was carried away from their own land to Assyria, as it is to this day. Now, as I say, some, mainly the poorer classes, were most likely left behind, and then these other people were brought in from other countries, from elsewhere, and they brought with them their own gods and so on and so forth. Now the question that confronts us now as we continue in this passage is, did they fare any better? Those Israelites who got away from God and served other gods, they've been removed from the land. Those that came in, and the few that were left behind, did they fare any better? God's judgment was on the others. Did these fare any better? Now, don't forget, these were people from various other nations, various other places. It says Babylon in verse 24, Cuthah, Avar, Hamath, Sepharvaim. They were pagans. They were not Israelites. They were not God's covenant people. They were, an expression in the New Testament is Gentile sinners. That's what they were. They weren't the people of God. They weren't the covenant people of God. They weren't Israelites. These were Gentile sinners. And as I say, when they came, they brought their own gods and religions with them. Verse 29 says, however, every nation continued to make gods of its own and put them in the shrines on the high places which the Samaritans have made, every nation in the cities where they dwelt. The men of Babylon made Sukkoth-Benoth, the men of Kuth made Nergal, the men of Hamath made Ashima, and the Avites made Nibhaz and Tartak, and the Sevavites burned their children in the fire to Adrammelech and Anamelech, the gods of Sepharvaim. So they brought their own gods with them, and it says they put them in the shrines. Now, many of these shrines actually already existed, if you remember. They were the shrines that had been used by the Israelites. Some of these shrines already had some of the foreign gods in that some of the Israelites had been worshipping. Some of them also mentions the high places where pagan religion was carried out. And so they brought their gods and they put their gods in these religious shrines and edifices that were already there. No doubt they built some of their own as well. Does that remind you of anything? I wonder. Remind you of anything? Buildings that once were used for Christian worship, bought by Muslims and turned into mosques, or Hindus and turned into temples that house their gods, and so on and so forth. Something we're seeing in increasing measure. Now, it may be true that many of those church buildings that I'm talking about, that are now mosques and temples and whatever else, it may well be true that some of those, I don't know, maybe many of them, really only ever knew a kind of false sort of Christianity, if you know what I mean. It may be that in many of those churches, the word of God was scarcely ever really preached, and the gospel was never preached. It might have been that in a lot of those buildings, this kind of like counterfeit version of the Christian faith was practiced. You know the sort of thing I mean? Just as you remember Jeroboam, remember the religion of Samaritan Israel was the religion of Jeroboam, and it was a counterfeit version of the true true Israelite religion. He appointed priests from whoever wanted to be a priest could be one, and he had similar feast days, similar celebrations, but it was a counterfeit of the real thing. Okay, and there is a form of Christianity, isn't there, that's Christian in name and carries out all the rituals and things like that, but it isn't the faith of the Bible really. You know, I'm not being unduly unkind. You know what I mean. Truth is that some of those buildings were buildings in which the true faith was preached as well, and I could take you to some of them. And it's certainly apparent. I mean, we've been to Wales like many times for our holidays, and Wales. I love Wales. I love the country, but I always find it kind of sad driving through Wales as well, because virtually every village you go through, there's a chapel there. And those chapels were built as a result either of the 1859 revival or the 1905 revival and what followed. And so there's all these chapels up and down the country where once they were houses where the gospel of Jesus Christ was preached, And now the carpet warehouses, or somebody's turned them into flats, or else the temples to another god, or whatever. But they are in disrepair, and it's very, very sad. And I've mentioned the place, of course, in Preston, where definitely the tram. I mean, I know a fella, and whenever I bump into him, he's grieved to the core, because this was the building in which he was converted. This was the building where he came to know the Lord. This was where he was initially taught the Christian faith. And now it's Preston City Mosque. And every time he drives past, he kind of has to look the other way. You know, it's a tragedy. So that is happening. And now these places, they've been turned, they've been dedicated to some foreign god, Allah or whatever it is. And if there were crosses on the wall, if there were something like that, or a verse from the Bible on the wall, all of that has been taken down. All of that has been removed from its place. Does that bother us? I wonder. Does it bother us at all? See, I know these, they're only buildings. And this is, yeah, they're just buildings. And you know, the Christian faith is not buildings. The Christian church is not a building of bricks and mortar. It's people. And I know all that. Nevertheless, those buildings represent something, don't they? Those buildings do represent something. And when a church becomes a mosque, when Preston City Church, as they'd renamed it shortly before its demise, when that became Preston City Mosque, that says something to everybody who goes by what is one of the busiest junctions in Preston. Everybody who goes through there, that says something. That says that church is no more, now it's a mosque. Well, actually, that church is still in existence that met there, but my friend told me it's split three ways now, and they meet in three different places. But you wouldn't know that. The place where they have met for decades is now a mosque. And that says something to me. It says something to the general public. But not only does it say something when these religions enter into the nation, enter into the continent, and begin to take over things in this way, it brings something too. It brings something in as well. See, coming back to Israel, they are... the covenant people of God. And when they broke that covenant that God made with them and failed to repent, even though God graciously kept sending prophets to tell them to, when they failed to repent and to serve the Lord, to fear the Lord and Him alone, God brought His judgment upon them. And He brought His judgment upon them in a particular way, peculiar to them. In the ways that God had actually Himself outlined in passages like Deuteronomy 28, verses 15 onwards to the end of the chapter. God described in the minutiae of detail the sort of judgments that would come upon His covenant people if they broke covenant. And the judgment came upon them in exactly the ways that God had said. At this particular point that we are up to here, they were removed from the land of promise, the land of blessing. Much later, after they rejected Christ as the Messiah, judicial blindness came upon Israel. They lost the temple. They were excluded from the land, although there were always Jews remained there, but in the main they were excluded from the land, have been scattered throughout the nations ever since, and will be until, the Bible says, the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled, at which point judicial blindness will be removed, and they will look upon Him who they pierced, and they will receive Him and believe on Him as their Messiah. They will receive Him, but right now, that God's peculiar judgment has come upon them in exactly the way that He said it would. Such judgments are peculiar to Israel. Alright? The Lord didn't say to the English people, as long as you fear the Lord and serve Him alone and keep His commandments, you'll be allowed to stay living in this green and pleasant land. But the minute you turn away from God and go after other gods, you will not be allowed to live in the land of England anymore. God never said that to the English people, or to the American people, or to the French, or to any other people. What I'm saying is, the judgments that came upon Israel were peculiar to them in that sort of sense. Nevertheless, coming back to this, the fact that these pagans who were brought to live in the land of Israel and were themselves not Israelites, not the covenant people of God, and when they came, they brought their own false gods in with them, doesn't mean, just because they weren't the covenant people of God, that they didn't receive any judgment from God for their sin and for their idolatry and for their wickedness, because they did. Verse 25 says, "And it was so at the beginning of their dwelling there that they did not fear the Lord. Therefore the Lord sent lions among them, which killed some of them." They were also under the judgment of God, albeit the judgment that came was different than the judgment that had just been meted out to Israel, God's covenant people. It was executed in a different way. See, God will judge all sin wherever he finds it, whether it's committed by a Jew or whether it's committed by a Gentile. God will judge sin wherever he finds it. Now, these Gentile sinners were obviously, they were already under the curse before ever they landed in the land of Israel, before they were ever brought there. They were under the curse, weren't they? They were still in darkness, they were still in blindness, they were still in the sins before ever they got there. And being in what now they brought into the land of Israel, now that they're in the land of milk and honey, the land of God's promise, right, where God had manifested himself in power in times past to his people, that didn't alter the fact for them that they were still under God's curse, that they were still under the judgment of God, did it? Being in that place didn't make any difference to that, did it? The fact that they were now in the land of Israel. If anything, I put it to you, it made the sin worse. Because this was a place where God had been made known in times past. And the fame of Israel went out far and wide. And God's dealing with them. I mean, even when they were in the wilderness, having just come out of Egypt. You remember when the two spies went to Jericho, and Rahab said to them, you know, people here have been frightened to death ever since you came out of Egypt, like, now 40 years ago. You know, because the fame of what God had done for them there had gone out. So this was a place where God, the one true and living God, had been made known in the past. Yet they, having come to the land of Israel, the place of God's promised blessing, they still continued with their own hideous gods that they brought with them. And they suffered for it. And what I'm getting to, you see, I see something of a kind of parallel with what is happening today in Europe and with Britain. I mean, here we are in Britain today, in Europe, and again, as I pointed out last week, this is my honest view, there is no such thing as a Christian country. I'm talking about a real Christian country. There's no such a thing, you know, where everybody is a true Christian in that. There's no such thing as a Christian country. The English people, or the peoples of the countries of Europe, are not the covenant people of God in a national sense, you know, in the way that Israel was. There's only one covenant people in a kind of national sense, and that is Israel, not any others, not Britain or Europe or America or any others. No such thing as a Christian country, really. Nevertheless, the best things we have in this country, the greatest blessings we enjoy in this country, do arise out of our Christian heritage. That's a fact. It comes out of the fact of our own Christian heritage, the freedoms that we enjoy, the wealth that we have. I know you could look at it another way and say we robbed the other nations to get it. You could say that. But even kind of, you know, the system it is and how we look after people. And I know there's lots of problems with all of that. And we can moan about everything, and we do. The Australians call us whinging poms because we're always moaning about something. But truthfully now, the way things are in this country and the benefits and blessings we enjoy here, many people in this world look upon it with envy. And it is patently obvious that there are thousands upon thousands of people in this world who would like to live here because of that. And the best things that we have, the best blessings we have, even that ability to go out and, you know, and earn money and gain wealth, you know, even that is part of the kind of ethic that comes from our Christian heritage. There's so much about what is good that derives from our Christian heritage. And as I say, there's many people in this world who would want to live here. Better to live here with all its problems than to live under the hardness and harshness and poverty and unfairness that exists in lands where it is under Islamic law and Islamic rule, or where true Hinduism is practiced. You watch that video, Veil of Tears, you know, and about the class system that exists in India traditionally, and that's all to do with the religion, you see. And so people far rather live here than live under that. Yet what do? When they come here, they bring their own religion, and God's with them. That actually is responsible for the harshness that they live under, and the hardness that they live under in some of those other countries, and the poverty, and countries where girls are not allowed an education, and women are second-class citizens, created only to serve man, and all the rest of it. And so they bring that with them here. And our tolerance and our acceptance of everyone and their own way of life and their own religious ideas, we open the doors completely to them and to their ideas at the same time as silencing the true Christians. You saw what happened to that woman in that video. I know that was Germany. But she's the Christian in a Christian cathedral, shouting out only Christian things. She's kicked out, and the imam is allowed to continue with his call to prayer. It's like Paul and I once went to a meeting, didn't we? And the imam there invited to speak in this church to a congregation of about 300 people, actually proclaimed the Lordship of Allah over that building in Arabic. I don't understand Arabic, but I knew what he was doing. And when I asked pertinent questions to him, questions before I went there, pre-designed by me so that I could preach the gospel in a question and show his religion to be false, the pastor was embarrassed, wasn't he, by what I'd said. And that's here. So what is happening? We open the doors to everyone and his dog with all their own ideas and let them have free rein, while at the same time we're trying to silence the Christian church. Now, some people in this that we read of in this passage realised, whether it was superstition or whether they really kind of recognised it or not, I'm not quite sure, but when these lions started multiplying and eating people, you know, they figured it, this was something to do with a god, the god of the land. You know, we're not doing it right here, like, you know. So they figured it was something to do with the god. And so what they did was they made an appeal to the king of Assyria. Okay, so he's the government, you know. And they put the case to him and said, look, you know, we don't know about the god of the land, you know, and people are getting eaten, you know. Obviously the god of the land isn't pleased with us. So the king of Assyria came up with this idea. Well, what we should do is bring back one of the priests, one of the Israelites that's been taken captivity and relocated. Bring him back to the land, then he can teach them how to serve, how to worship the God of the land, and then everything will be all right. Okay, that was the idea of the government. That was the idea of the king. Unfortunately, though, the priest who they brought back was not a true believing, God-fearing, Bible-believing Jew, you know, who was practicing the real faith of Israel. He was one of those priests who served Jeroboam's counterfeit religion, you see. So he came back and taught them what? The truth? No, he taught them that kind of pluralistic, syncretized religious belief, that counterfeit thing that Jeroboam's religion was believed. And the result was, it says, they feared the Lord and served their own gods. And when I was looking at this Bible study, I was particularly struck by verses 33 and 34, where it says, they feared the Lord, yet served their own gods, according to the rituals of the nations from among whom they were carried away. To this day, they continue to practice the former rituals. They do not fear the Lord, nor do they follow the statutes or their ordinances, or the law and the commandment which the Lord had commanded the children of Jacob, whom he renamed Israel. And it's what I say about that, it says they feared the Lord, they did not fear the Lord. So what did they do? Did they fear him or did they not fear him? Well, when it says they feared him, it seems to me that can only mean they kind of accepted the probability of his existence. So they acknowledged him, in a sense, and acknowledged that there was a people here who worshipped him, but they didn't really fear him in the true sense that God calls his people to fear him and him alone. That is to say, reverence him and receive him and acknowledge him and worship him and him alone, because he alone is God. They're not fearing him in the true sense. They're paying lip service, in a sense. So they kind of think that they can do both, you see. And so what I'm coming to, and my conclusion, is really this. If the peoples who come to this nation and come to Europe and bring Allah with them, or the gods of Hinduism, or wherever else they've come from, and they come here and they find themselves in the position that some of these are, and they still feel like somewhat that things are not all together right, and they were to go to our government and ask them about to point them in the direction of someone who can tell them about the God of this land, the God that was traditionally worshipped in this land, who do you think our government would send them to? What priest or pastor do you think our government would put them in touch with? Be it Archbishop of Canterbury, wouldn't it? Or somebody like that. Yeah. Or maybe Cardinal, whatever his name is. You know, it would be a representative of that church. They wouldn't be sending them to somebody akin to that woman on that video. Or somebody who is, you know, a biblical fundamentalist, would they? They'd be sending them to the sort of person who's actually towing the government line of interfaith. Would that then, if they did, because actually they are, the government have strategies to bring the religious leaders together and promote interfaith. And that really is that. That's what is happening, putting them together. But the question is, would that be of any help to anybody in the end? You know, this woman here in Sweden, who says, let's take the crosses off the wall, let's remove all symbolism of Christianity, let's make a room pointing to Mecca where Muslims can pray, let's make it open so that anybody of any faith can feel open to come. Is that, it's welcoming, if they want to come, but is that removing from them the curse? Is that removing from them the judgment of God that is on them? No, only the gospel will do that. All that is doing is continuing the problem and leaving them under the judgment of God. And the chapter finishes by saying they've continued to to do that to this present day. The children have done it, the children's children, up until the time that was written, they were still doing the same thing. And as long as people, wherever they come from, go to a false Christianity for the answers, or to ecumenicalism, will never help them at all. What we need in this country and in Europe is more people like that woman, in my opinion, who've got the courage to actually stand up for what they believe. That's what we need. Somebody to preach the truth. But of course, in the coming days, the more you do that, the more trouble you're going to be in. But that is what is needed, in my opinion. Amen.